Recognizable at first glance. They emerge with increasing clarity only as we experience them. They take on a living reality to the degree that we are able to penetrate the mask that hides us from ourselves.
Does anybody have joys or sorrows to share with us this morning?
It was a joy to hear the piano, and that was by, what was that piece?
Sibelius. That was very meditative.
It was a joy. Yesterday, the Martin Luther Trio, Ruth and George and I, were asked to play at a lesbian wedding at James Reed. And the service was so wonderful and something really to learn from. And it was, I think, for all of us, it was a great joy.
Many of you here probably remember Dave Sackham, who has been this year in Vientiane Models. He will be coming back to Madison for about 2 weeks. He'll be staying with us, and he arrives June 26th.
Great. Well, I just returned from a 2 week vacation in Seattle, staying with people I love and attending the Special Library Association annual convention. And this is the first time I've been to a national convention in over 15 years, and I went through career advisement and job placement, which is very professionally affirming.
Yeah, my dad called me yesterday. He's about 85 years old, and he's only called me a handful of times in my life, but I remembered him on Father's Day, and I sent him a series of cards. Well, actually, there was three, and then there's a fourth one, and I put in some confetti, some little cow confetti, and he just called me to thank me. We had such a nice conversation, and one of the cards had a button that said a very lovely day, and he was wondering if he should wear that when my mom and he and some friends go out to lunch, and I encourage him to take a risk and wear it. Just a nice conversation.
Oh, very good. It's a sorrow to me that the jury in Denver came back with the verdict of death for Timothy McVeigh.
Other joys or sadness? Oh, I know one thing I was going to say. It was a joy to come and see the work of the Housing and Property Committee. You noticed that the wider walkway out there, and
I spent 4 hours yesterday, and Rick Owens spent probably about 6 or 7 hours working on that, and we bought over 90 pounds of sand, which would have wrecked my car, but then you guys were killed. Thing you can carry it in. All, nearly was a lot for his truck, his thing too. So, and it's not quite done yet, but it will be shortly once it's swept.
Is it blocked then, the gravel between?
Yes. And I just want to say too, I would like to ask people if a couple of you would like to write Rick a note of thanks, that would be great. I think a good way, since he's not here today, maybe you can just. For those of you who particularly appreciate that or particularly use that, if you could send a note thanking him for his work on that, I think that would be a nice way to show gratitude. Because that's like, you know, when you think about it, it's like 6 hours of time, you know, working on that. It's a lot of time. You know, and if you spend 6 hours on anything that's like that, particularly that's work, I mean, but maybe being in the choir is a little plumber, in my opinion. But Rick does enjoy that. He's very good at that. So I would just like to ask a couple people to send a note of thank you. And you can thank me in other ways.
I was grateful to see that the wobbly railing has kind of been removed. And I'm assuming it's going to be replaced. Is there anything we can do to make the holes bigger so you can get it deeper? Because it was really bad.
We can talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk about that afterwards. They're anxious to get going. We're going to sing Deacon Duncan's and Fry question mark. I have a feeling that we have different words, and it's on the back of your program. And maybe best have some light for this. So people can be here.
How many verses are
there? Let's see.
Well, four, five.
You wrote five.
How many do you want to?
I guess the breadest.
Could you just give us an idea of the meter?
Yes.
How would you sing the first line?
Thank you.
introduction for our topic than what I have written down here in great detail. And since we're a little late in starting, I think I'm going to throw out the introduction. I've handed out a few quotes because you get the idea. Better from the leader's song than you would from the classical quotes that I had chosen. And Nikki and I have a lot of stuff to share with you, so we don't want to leave any time. Now, images are the products of the interplay between our imagination and reality. And this is what we would like to keep in mind. They are the product of our own imagination and our very own reality. They are an integral part of life, and such as a topic, it's a topic much too vast for a couple of short prairie programs. But when Nikki and I talked about our respective research areas, we felt we did have something to share with you all and decided to focus on external visually images, mainly paintings, graphics, photographs, in my case a little bit of literature, that shape as well as reflect our attitudes, beliefs, and social norms. That's what images do. Especially in the second half of the 20th century, which is now, or almost the end of the 20th century, where there is almost or really no escape from the fallout of the explosion of visuals, of electronic imagery. It might be well for us to step back and look at the way in which images function in their historic context, because images, whether they're internal, in the mind's eye or external, always exist in a context. They're never just out of the no. Can we have that? we'd like to stimulate your visual faculties a bit, maybe stir up a little controversy and encourage discussion after our presentation. And finally, and I say this right now so I and you won't forget it, we'd ask you to bring for next Sunday a few of your own slides, a few, and other visuals that may be relevant to our topic. So this, the next Sunday should be really an interactive kind of thing. As you can see from the song just now, the topic has already stimulated Delita to create a great new text for a great old song. Now I'm going to start by showing you or talking about a small sampling of my own work and research on stereotype and prejudice in general as a kind of case study to show you how and under what socio-political and historical circumstances images of the other can develop, be created, or completely changed. And keep in mind, images, clichés, stereotypes are really part of a continuum. One can feed into the other and become the other. And as a German, a hyphenated American, a German-American, I will talk about what I know first. And I'll begin with two with two caricatures. The first one, now we can bring it to life again. Problems here. I can see here. This is the stereotype of a German, as seen through Anglo-American eyes, drawn by a German cartoonist in a German weekly, illustrating an article that expressed irritation at the continued use of this image, implicitly or explicitly, in American media. Particularly annoying was the fact that now, that was in a couple of years back, during the Gulf War, the Germans didn't seem to conform to their warlike images. If you recall, they didn't want to send troops. The next one. I think maybe I better do some mention there because I know how this is going to be. I'm going to come back here. Oh, okay, thanks. This is the stereotype of an American, as seen through European eyes, drawn by an American cartoonist, illustrating an article in an American weekly expressing indignation at the increasingly negative image of America in European, including German eyes.
Can you move back a little bit?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think you got enough stretch there. Just about. Thank you.
All right, we'll wrap you up here with that word. That's fine.
Thank you.
Now, both images contain certain realities seen through the filter of the other's selective perception. We all have our selective perception. A perception that is shaped by political affiliation, historical knowledge or ignorance, personal experience, and prejudice. On the German side, the kernel of truth is, of course, a history of militarism reaching a peak at the time of the Wilhelminian Empire, hence the long outdated helmet. Lederhosen and Bierstein, however, are typical only of one small segment of the country, Bavaria. But being significantly different from anything found in Anglo-American culture, that image goes on and on and on, like that rabbit in the Duracell battery. On the American side, the equally simplistic and popular image is that of the cowboy and his gear, 10-gallon hat, Western boots, and guns. Here it's a gun belt. But look what he does with it. Tunnel vision under his big hat, the white hat with patriotic righteousness, of course. He has an itchy trigger finger, and he subscribes to gun belt diplomacy. His high heels serve to crush un-American activities. With the neck scarf, he strangles peacenicks, and under his barrel chest, he seems to have a hardening of the heart. Now, how close to the alleged new German image of the ugly American does this caricature come? Well, it appeared at the time of the Gulf War, and just about at that time, I found this portrait of the nation's number one, the then nation's number one cowboy, in one of Germany's major women's magazines. And to quote from the text, in his world, evil lurks everywhere. It comes from godless communists, Libyan terrorists, jobless moochers who only want to get their hands on the hard-earned dollars of millionaires. But he showed them. He showed them, didn't he? With cowboy hat and Western boots, Ronald Reagan stomped through world politics and did not hesitate to leave a few corpses along the way. But there is another image of the American cowboy that has existed long before this political critical view I talked about, and it is embodied in the Marlboro Man, Germany's most enduring and popular cigarette advertising symbol, even today. A ruggedly handsome sunbronzed cowboy, a bit rougher than Gary Cooper and not quite as beefy as John Wayne, he pauses for a smoke, overlooking a grandiose panorama of Sierra or Grand Canyon landscape.
Rosemary, have you seen the new man?
Yeah, let me go on, okay? This image epitomizes that deep old longing for the freedom to roam wide open spaces. A cliche, ein Wunschtraum, a wish dream, or a fantasy, but one that has a long tradition in this highly structured, small, densely populated country. And no one knows more about the appeal of such fantasies than the highly sophisticated market research that goes into the making of advertising. However, Marlboro Man is dead. And now we have a turnaround of the image. I'm sure some of you have seen the advertisements on television by the brother of the late Marlboro Man, who talks about what the cigarette and tobacco industry does, and shows a picture of the dying full of tubes, the dying man full of tubes, emphysema, cancer, and so forth. Now, how Germans perceive the American Indian. Cowboys and Indians, of course, go together, before the advent of American movies, was largely determined by two authors, James Fenimore Cooper, 1789 to 1851, and the German Karl May, 1852 to 1912. Cooper's novels were the first literary self-portrait of North America to reach a German audience, and their success, particularly on the leather stocking tales, was enormous. Welcomed by publishers as light reading with an exotic flavor, they were quickly edited and abridged, sometimes by as much as 25%, so that what remained of Cooper's fairly differentiated characters were basically the good and evil stereotypes, with a sensationalist edge on the cruel red savage. But while Cooper's tales, written in England, were colored by nostalgic longing for his homeland, as Leslie Fieser points out. Karl May's Winnetou, that's the name of his most popular Indian character, Winnetou and Wild West are sheer fantasy. May never set foot on American soil until 1908. Here's Karl May in his favorite outfit. A frustrated Kleinbürger, a petit bourgeois, who had grown up in abject poverty, Karl May had failed as a teacher and spent about 7 years in jail for fraud and petty larceny. And he finally virtually wrote his way out of a miserable existence. His tales of adventure in the American West and in the Near East have by now sold 25 million copies and are still going strong. I lived with them as a young teenager. And above all, Winnetou, his three-volume saga of the noblest, bravest, most kind-hearted, and beautiful Apache of all times, stimulated enormous interest in and fascination with American Indians. While ultimately the advent and influx of American movies has superimposed its image of the American West on German perceptions, and I'm not saying all Germans, but certainly parts of German perception, the indigenous Winnetou remains indestructible. And I'll run through a couple of slides. This is Winnetou as one of the many outdoor festivals on Karl May and his Wild West stories. And going back to this, see, now the backward doesn't work again.
Wait, I'll do it.
You're
going to
do it? Okay. Back. Okay, these two slides, can you go back one more, are not taken in South Dakota. These are the annual meetings. This is from the annual meetings of about 65 Western clubs that exist in Germany, in today's Germany, then cowboys and Indians are leading a peaceful coexistence. In 1977, statistics show 15,000 Germans were then organized in more than 65 clubs with names like Friends of the Prairie or U.S. Cavalry, and they meet for camps or powwows at least once a year. They're living out this frontier fantasy of the wide open spaces, the freedom, and so forth. Now, living out these frontier fantasies is not cheap. The members wear authentic, often handmade leather gear, a beautiful fringed and beaded Indian clothing, even sleeping in handmade leather tents.
Probably more authentic than here now.
Well,
we've done traditional stuff.
But it's interesting, you know, it still is an overcrowded small country, and there still is this longing for the myth of the wide open spaces. However, there are some ecology-minded groups and or more politically left groups who are pointing to the Indians' relation to the land now for a different kind of ecological relationship with the land and so forth. That's another movement, but that's another story. Okay. Now, that was one series of ads, of images on Americans and West. I have now a few, I'm shifting too much now. What this little introduction was meant to show is the origin, the use, and dissemination of an image are more revealing of its source than of the people represented. In other words, the noble cowboys, the crafty and cruel Indians, the fat black mammies and dumb bimbos in American movies of the 30s and 40s, very popular in Germany as well before World War II, tell us nothing about the realities of working cowhands, dispossessed Native Americans, or racially oppressed blacks. But they do reveal a great deal about the attitudes of the society in which they are produced and disseminated. And this is really the point I wanted to make. So maybe you can keep that in the back of your minds. I'd like to show you now some slides of another body of research that I had done that gives you another slant of basically the similar principle and similar theory. In 1980, I finished my dissertation for the University of Wisconsin here with a dissertation on the images of blacks in West German popular magazines, popular fiction, popular mass media. And I created this title page, my publisher let me do that, juxtaposing this beautiful drawing from the year 1523 done by Albrecht Dürer, one of the great American artists, juxtaposing this with this dehumanizing, horrible, cannibal cartoon from the year 1959. And my question was, how did we get from this to that? There are reasons. These things don't just change or take place in people's minds. There are always historical reasons. And we have only a short time, so I'll run just through a few examples to drive home my point. We started in Germany with a black African saint, Saint Maurice, who still stands in front of a Superman, more than man height, statue in front of the Magdeburg Cathedral. This is from 1230. This is perhaps one of the most beautiful images of St. Maurice from the 15th century, 15th to the 16th century. And in between, there were many beautiful images, religious images of St. Maurice as part of the Madonna with Child, and he was one of the three kings, the three magi, representing the young continent Africa. Now, the representations were very realistic, very beautiful. This is the counterpiece of the Dürer painting. This is a woman in Rotterdam who lived in Rotterdam in the early 16th century, and Dürer drew her very carefully, lovingly, realistically. But when you think in terms of Saint Maurice, who was extremely popular in public art, what better symbol to attest to the power of Christianity than a real, honest-to-goodness, black person, a black saint? And of course, without putting down the artworks themselves, the symbolic value for the church was tremendous of having a black saint attesting to Christianity. And the story of Saint Maurice goes back to a legend. He was at one time a Roman legionnaire who died, who became a martyr for Christianity. So there you see the various aspects of an image in symbolic art. This is a Swedish painting from the Renaissance days in the early 1600s. And it exemplifies perfectly what happened to images of Africans in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century. The Renaissance brought about a tremendous interest in anything exotic, anything from other worlds. The discovery, quote-unquote, discovery of Africa took place. And the courts of Europe brought across from North Africa, where North African Islamic blacks and sultans sold poor Africans to the white traders. There was an insidious trading going on between the colors. And they brought them to the courts as status symbols. And so at the courts of Europe during these decades, you will find Hofmohren, court Moors, that are dressed very well, sometimes gorgeously dressed, beautiful. And this is a young child that served as decoration, as status symbols at the courts, sort of as pets of the court, along with what we saw before, exotic birds, exotic animals, and other treasures. So I don't have time to go into that, but I'm working on a study of showing the images and the historic reality of the lives of these Africans. That's too long a thing. A little bit later, in about the 18th century now, early 18th century, the blacks no longer are portrayed as individuals, but they serve as contrast foil to some of the beautiful court ladies. Or here, one of the princesses. This is by Antoine Pen in the 18th century. So their value declines. Their value as a decoration remains, but their human value declines. Here is a very precious piece of china ware, porcelain, that you can find in Dresden. In the 19th century, I'm doing this very fast, as you can see, the missionaries became very important, and colonization spread more and more, and you see more images of Africans as the sweet little converted Christians. And the pastor is the godlike figure there, and the very compliant and very nice Christianized little blacks are more or less, are becoming more or less little puppets. Another trend in the 19th century is the erotic exoticism. The contrast between the black and the white skin is very obvious here. This is supposed to be, the topic of this is supposed to be the Mohrenwäsche. There's another biblical thing that you cannot wash a Mohr black person white. And this is an illustration which at the same time is a rather erotic kind of representation. I'm jumping now to the time right after the First World War. You have some changes. The Expressionists felt free to do their own thing. You know enough about Expressionism. And there's one woman, and right now I'm forgetting her name, who did some very good portraits and paintings of South African blacks, and she got into the working people too. This is a representation of a worker in South Africa. And in the Expressionist time, you also have some semi-abstract representations of blacks, but no longer the painstaking, realistic, lovingly careful drawing that Albert Dürer did. Another trend, which was very insidious, began around the turn of the century, and those were the so-called ethnic displays, the Völkerschauen. The first of these ethnic displays took place in the Jardin des Plantes in the 1870s in Paris. But in Germany, they also took place widely. And you can see the cut off Zoologischer Garten zu Frankfurt. I got a bunch of them out of the Frankfurt Zoo archive. And here, whole families or groups of Somalis or Ghanans or other, Sinhalese were brought to the European countries, put in the zoos, in the open air enclosures of the zoos, supposedly to teach people about ethnology and anthropology, this is not my morning to speak, anthropology. But we can assume that very few people had a great ethnological or anthropological interest. It was sensationalism, and of course there were a lot of bare-bosomed women and bare-chested men, and there are some wonderful gossipy stories of Paris, Berlin, Munich society women who were going to the tents where they lived, sneaked in and brought, sent them presents, and even tried for some assignations. So, but the whole thing, of course, is, I don't need to comment what this really said. You see the Zoological Garden. One of the most popular shows here, also taking place in the zoo in Frankfurt and in other places, was this group of supposed Amazons. From Cameroon. There were no Amazons. There was no such thing as an Amazon group in Africa, but they were the most successful ethnic displays for very obvious sensationalist reasons. Now, in the during the late part of the 1900s, when imperialist colonialism really came to full bloom. And also the mass media began to appear because of certain technical innovations. This image was established, and that's the one that was still around in 1959 when I showed you my book cover. The jokes about Africans assuming, the paraphernalia of the accoutrements of the so-called civilized world. This is called biting cannibal, and so they are really vicious. And one of the most famous children's stories shows, this is interesting for the graphic arts oriented, the image of the ape, or the form, shape of the ape, is exactly like the shape of the African's picture here. And so this sort of thing was printed in children's books. And slowly there was a process of total dehumanization of the image of Africans, with always some notable exceptions, but the popular press is what disseminated this kind of imagery. And I wanted to finish this series here, I don't want to go on, take the time from Mickey, to remind you this is really what we started out with in about, this is about 1514. So this just as a bit of a stimulation to think, when you see images, think about where they originated, what they used for, what maybe the the background, the historical background, and so forth. I'm going to stop right here, thank you, so that Nikki can get going on her stuff. And in the meantime, I'll bring you back to the present tense with a song that I heard on WRT, and I asked Chris Powers to lend it to me. Mike, would you turn this on? No, I'll stop here. I won't show you anything too much.
And they disallowed my business lunches today. Somebody must have changed the rules of the game. So we found a convenient state called Weekend Lane. Those teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs. Somebody ran this country deep into debt. I called up Congress, but nobody's called back yet. Sometimes I get so mad I can't think straight. We're looking for relief and it feels so great to hate. All those teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs. And the drought. Who's to blame for the end of the good old days? Who's to blame for that backwards cat wearing praise? Those teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Held a thousand miles back.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Spectacular. I'm going to go from, since my, can you all hear me? It's okay? My field, yes? No?
Yes.
Okay. My field is photography, and what I just want to talk about to continue on imagery is to talk a little bit about understanding photographs and to let you see that the images, that many people think that photographs are real, which they're not, nor are they unreal, but to let you see that images are exactly what we make them to be. And there are ways that you can look at photographs and you can understand that this image that's presented to you is what the photographer wanted you to see. Since photography was made available to the world in 1839, it's been a source of information, and it's looked upon as reality or real. And actually, 20 years later, after the introduction of a common form of photography to the world, Oliver Wendell Holmes called photography the mirror with memory. And he predicted there would be vast libraries of photographs, just as there were books. And of course, that's what I do. I take care of several million historical photographs. So Oliver Wendell Holmes was right on. I want to point something out about Oliver Wendell Holmes. He was the person who gave us the term photography. Though he was not an inventor, he gave us a lot of things that have to do with photography today, but that's history of photography. Okay, let's see if we can get the right one. The camera does what the eye cannot do. It fixes an event or thing in time. It removes an instant from the flow of time and holds it unchanging, unlike our memories. It allows us to study something closely that we would never have a chance to know. It also allows the chance to follow and examine change in our world. It permits us to observe people living in a different time and place. It is important to understand two things. A photograph is an artifact of society that can be interpreted just like other artifacts such as bones, pottery, or anything. Photographs neither lie nor tell the truth. They merely present what the photographer chose to tell you. I hope you can see what this is.
Giant peaches.
To be able to understand a photograph, you need to know the attitudes and conventions that the photographer and photography had at the time that the photograph was made. Sometimes a photograph is mainly the bearer of information, evidence of an event. It may be revealed who was there, what people wore, the setting of the event. In this photograph, if you look very carefully right in the middle, there's a man holding a clapboard, and that photograph was taken to document that site because it was going to be destroyed to put up the Union Station in Kansas City. The taking of a photograph often confers importance on an event, and the existence of the photograph shows that this was something of importance to the person who had it made. There are many technical choices in photography that determine what the image says. Unlike painting, photography is made with the use of a piece of equipment. From what vantage point the photo was taken, and how does this affect the meaning of the photo? The telephoto lens, which compresses space, makes connections between unrelated events or things. It also says certain things that the photographer wanted it to say. The physical optics of the camera lens make connections that our eyes can't, as does the ability of the photographer to photograph the world from a different viewpoint than eye level. A close-up view is used to engage the viewer's sympathy, to connect us, and to make us feel a part of the subject. The wide-angle lens puts emotional meanings into situations. Journalists in particular often use it to manipulate our feelings. It can create a sense of despair. It can create a sense of despair, unconnectedness, and distance in a scene. And this is the most commonly used lens, is the wide-angle lens. When you look at your photographs in the newspaper, they use wide-angle lenses. There's a man named Jim Goldberg, a photographer, who did a book called Rich and Poor. And he used a wide-angle lens. He had a very clear vision that he wanted to say. All of his photographs of rich people are using a wide-angle lens. They're usually sitting alone in a room, which makes you feel like this enormous distance and despair. And so what he's saying is his clear take on the rich is that they're all despairing people with shallow lives. And he's using a wide-angle lens to do that. And when he photographs poor people, he uses either the close-up lens like that or a normal lens, which is equivalent to our own vision. This is a person who had a specific thing to say and is using the technical ability of the camera to do it. Different shutter speeds can create different meanings. In this case, this is also using a wide-angle lens, but the photographer is using it to create a sense of mystery, as is this photographer, to create a sense of mystery and mood. In the case of the one on the right-hand side, the blurred person in the cryptic writing, which if it was bigger, you could see it's above the person, was meant to evoke the sense of a spiritual journey of waiting and transition. To come to something we all know, Frank Lloyd Wright. Whoops. Sorry, Frank Lloyd Wright. There we go. This is just a quickie thing to show you about what technical things say. The photograph on the left is by a man named Hendrick, and what he's doing is showing the relationship of the house and the terraces and the rocks and the water. He shows you the slabs that support the house. He shows you each of the elements, and those are all shown to you by photographing the house in strong lighting that clearly defines each element. The house is explained. What he's doing is explaining the house to you by using the strong lighting that shows all the different elements of the structure. A man named Futagawa did the one on the right. He begins with a fairly similar viewpoint, but what he does is abstracts the elements, the concrete terraces, the trees, the rocks, and the water. To make them into abstractions, he has used diffuse lighting from an overcast day, which gives a timeless feeling to the scene. Whereas Hendrik is showing the building blocks and the elements that form the house as they are rooted in a particular time and place, Futagawa shows the mood and the spiritual sense of the building. Of the photograph. Where was it taken? Obviously, these two photographs had to be taken in very different places. You have a kind of a big clue in the one on the left-hand side in that it's got a lighthouse in it. What clues are there to the geographical landscape? Is it flat? Is it mountainous? What clues are there to the cultural landscape? What does this say? The photograph on the right-hand side is a grave out on the prairie. Actually, if you ask me about it personally, I'll tell you the reality of that photograph. But what does this say about the cultural landscape? What do you see about the time, about the people? What kind of people lived in this photograph? How does the photograph reveal the time of day, the season, the year? There is one clue in this photograph on the left-hand side that this cannot possibly be a photograph from before the turn of the century. And that is because there are truck tire tracks right in the middle of it. And sometimes clues are subtle. Sometimes they'll beat you over the head. A photograph depicts only one physical or temporal aspect of an event. There is always a hidden side, an appreciable part of the event that is not recorded. In this case, people are watching a fire, but what the journalist focused on was the observation, the act of observation, not the fire, which was the thing that the people were looking at. The other thing is details. This is the most important part of the photograph. How do the details contribute to the whole? How do they help in drawing conclusions about time, place, and meaning of an event? These are two photographs. This is Junction City, Kansas in 1900. The second photograph was taken as a rephotographic photo to try to exactly imitate the first, and it was taken in 1985. If you begin to look at the details, and I have to apologize for not having the ability to give you show you larger slides. But if you look at some of the details, you can see things, for example, that transportation was horse and wagon. There are dirt streets. The street is a place for socialization and pedestrians. If you looked way down sort of to the lower left, there are people in the street. There are masses of wires in the sky, which if you look very carefully here, you can see wires. There is a new courthouse in the background, or if you don't know that, I happen to know it's a new courthouse, but there is a courthouse building there that seems pretty vital. The second stories, and this is an important thing about American life, the second stories of the buildings are utilized. If you look, there is a staircase where the word Tribune is. You can see the windows. You can see there is a name of a business up on the second floor. These buildings reflect the prosperity of the merchants in the town, and one of the buildings, if this was big enough, it is brand new. It says 1899 in the cornice. This photograph was taken in 1900. When you compare those details to the photograph, the later photograph, you see that the streets are paved. It's very clearly only for the use of cars. There are no pedestrians. The road is no longer the main route. If you look down to the right-hand side of the photo, there's a sign. There's a street sign and a traffic marker sign, and it says alternate route. That detail tells you that this is no longer the main way that people go through the town. The top of the courthouse is gone, so you can see the change over time. There are very few wires. Of course, we put our wires underground or somewhere. I don't know where they go now, but we have them. We don't have them above our heads very much anymore. The large stone buildings, if you look very carefully at both photographs in the middle of the photo on the left-hand side, you will notice that the town continued to grow because there were the buildings that were small frame buildings became large stone buildings. So you know that the town did become, for some time at least, prosperous after 1900. You can see the changes that have come to our society because of the automobile, which are reflected in the curtain screens, which are those large blank walls that are over the second stories. They are no longer used. The automobile affected our society greatly. We don't live vertically anymore. We live horizontally. These two photos are the indication that we used to live vertically, meaning that we used the second stories. Everything was very compact. It was for the pedestrian. We no longer use the second stories. We cover them up. We don't need any windows. They are of no value to us. They're empty. They're not even noticed in these. They aren't even used for apartments. If you look at the top of the buildings, also at the top, very carefully, you can notice these are only cosmetic changes and not physical changes. These are what are called curtain screens. They're literally tacked onto the front of the building. You also can see change over time because the icky green curtain screen is a 50s thing. Below it and all the way to the right-hand side, you can see a little bit of the fake mansard, which was a 70s and 80s. Trying to be environmental, everything became fake mansard with wooden roofs. That's trying to evoke a sense of environmentalism. So you can see the time period, the styles changing over time. And one last thing you can see, which is very interesting, is if you look at the building that has scaffolding on it, where you can see the windows again, this photograph was taken in the 1980s, where we had the Main Street historicalization, and they are in the process of taking that curtain screen off so that they can take it back to the 1900 photo. So you can see what happened there is the images that we want just recycle. They cycle over time. Anyway, this is to show you that there are many details that can tell you if you know how to look and read. Now I want to go to people. This is John the cook and Frank the cook. And I have to confess that my photograph's just a little aside. But these were two people who are cooks who I knew in Maine. And what you look at in a photograph, you don't have to see a person's face to know about them. You don't have to. You look at how do they present themselves. What are these people like? And it should be very clear that these are very different people who have very different senses of themselves. And that's what they show. The man on the left was a wrestler. He was very secure in his body and in himself. The man on the right was a very tall, gawky guy, wonderful cook, but was a very awkward and did not feel really at ease with himself. Also, there's a little irony in this too. He's wearing a camera. He was a cook. They were both cooks for a photography workshop. Neither of them did do photographs. When you look, what kind of relationships are shown in photographs? What do the ways people are relating mean? Are people touching? What emotions are projected by each? What is revealed about people by the spacing or direction of their bodies? Also, the way that in which they are dressed and the way in which they're posed. The lower photograph on the right-hand side is Jane Mansfield and her daughter. And you notice that there's a childlikeness. It's almost like the child has to be the adult in this particular circumstance, and the mother is more of the child. When you look at people, observe how groups are, how they are posed, who is touching, who is standing apart, who is next to whom. And if you see in the middle of this photo, the parents are enfolding the small child in the middle, which tells you something about how they regard that child. You see the child is sort of enveloped by the whole family. Over on the left-hand side, you have two boys who are standing apart and have a sense of distance from the family. And the girl, also on the right-hand side, is not really touching. Oftentimes, people will unconsciously touch them. When they're having a photo taken, they will turn their body toward the person or touch them in some manner. And obviously, this is more formal posing in an earlier photograph, but there are still small indications. If you notice that the woman has her hand down on the child, and there's a small indication on the other, but the girl on the right-hand side is in no way touching the people in her family, or she's also not turned toward them. Here's another pose of a group in this way. You can see how these people feel comfortable with each other. Obviously, they're a working crew. They're Union Pacific workers. They're a working crew. But they have a sense of familiarity. They lean toward each other, particularly the two in the middle, where the one with sort of her hand on her pocket is leaning toward the other one, which can indicate certain senses of friendship and who feels what way. They also are people who show themselves as very secure in what they do and what they know. Different choices say different things. A photographer chooses very carefully what they want to say. This is in these two photographs, these are both photographs of very famous people. They're taken by different photographers. The photograph on the left is a photograph of Edward Weston, who is a major, major figure in photography, who influenced a great number of people. He's portrayed by the photographer as godlike, using the choice of viewpoint, looking up at him. This is emphasized by the fact that he has his hands on his hips, the strong locks are behind him. And the photographer here is giving the sense of feeling of this person as a godlike person. On the other hand, the photograph of Albert Schweitzer is taken in a very different manner. In this place, he had a great reputation, and the photographer emphasized that Schweitzer as a part of the human community. He connected to all of us as one of us. He focused on his humanity by showing him in a vulnerable pose with his head down and focusing on his soft organic hair, which is messy and unkempt, just like the rest of us. So these two people were saying two vastly different things about these famous people. These two photographers are saying two very different things about medicine. In the first photo on the left, the purpose of the photographer is to show what an operating room was like, the equipment, the uniforms. It was not to show the business of medicine, but really to kind of show the accoutrements. The photo was set up with the assistance of the people in the photo who are showing their workplace. The photo on the right-hand side by W. Eugene Smith focuses on the person, the humanity, the pain of medicine. It doesn't show how medicine is done. It shows the caring. And you notice it's a tight, close-up focus on the person's face. It gives direct participation of the photographer in the event, where the photographer on the left-hand side is not participating in the event, but merely recording it, and making no judgment and giving no feeling about it. So these are two different views of medicine. One is the tools and environment of medicine, and the other is the view of the humanity of medicine. And here are three different views I wanted to give you of images of churches to show you how photographers are saying three different things using photographs of churches. This photograph by Ansel Adams presents the church as a symbol of religion. The composition and the choice of viewpoint draws your eye upward and makes the church the central element. This is enhanced by the lighting, which makes the church stand out against the darkness. And this lighting was achieved purposely by using a polarizing filter to make the sky dark. In this case, Adams knew exactly what he wanted to achieve. He wanted to show you the church is a symbol of religion. In this photograph by Dorothea Lange, she shows the church as a social institution in the environment, which in this case is the Great Plains. She emphasizes the importance of religion to the society. Notice that you see three churches right there. She has chosen to show how many churches there are in a small space. She wanted to show how important that the church is as an institution in society. And in this last photograph of the church, here the photographer is merely showing you the building. The photographer was not saying anything about the church, but merely that this was a Presbyterian church building in Anthony, Kansas. You notice the lighting is flat. It's not particular. It's just simply there to show you this is what the Presbyterian church in Anthony, Kansas looked like. It's very specific to a time and a place. Just as any other data has to be evaluated for accuracy or proper interpretation, so do photographs. The sociologist Howard Beckard recommends a test for the truthfulness of a photograph. His method is a way to analyze the conclusions you draw from it. He recommends that you look at a number of photographs of the same event, subject, or topic, and these questions be asked of each of them. What is the truth the photograph asserts? What part of a greater truth is the truth the photograph asserts? In other words, look at more than one. Is this truth representative or characteristic of the subject, or is it posed, faked, or manipulated? What is known about the photographer or his or her artistic style that may have biased the truth? That's what I told you about Jim Goldberg in the case of Richard Ford, that he's using a technical device to make you think that rich people are all sort of in despair. Has the archivist, that's the person who collects the photographs, such as someone like me, contributed to censorship of the truth by the process and selection of elimination. In other words, I won't take those photos. One example of that is that it's upsetting to see photos of dead babies, but that's a very common thing in turn-of-the-century photographs, and oftentimes archivists won't keep those, but that's a part of society. That's what you did. Is there other supporting evidence? Are there other photos, manuscripts, or oral material? Am I interpreting it with a 1990s moral, cultural, or technical standard? In other words, people in old photographs don't smile, so they must have been depressed. Well, that's not true. The exposures were so long that it was very difficult to hold a smile. So is there lack of knowledge? In other words, am I putting something from the 1990s into this, into interpreting it? And in the end, there is more to photography than meets the eye. I did it. That's it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I guess we'll go over the rest of the program now. I want to remind you one more time, if you're coming next Sunday, please bring something to share. You've heard a lot of different aspects about imagery. We want to do an intro here on that topic. We will still have some slides to show.
Any aspect you want
to do. Whatever is important to you, what you could relate to what you may have noticed or even learned today.
I'll be bringing. Talking a little bit about photographers who use photography for spiritual purposes.
Yeah. And I have a few paintings that feed into that topic also, from slides of painting. But there's enough time for everyone to do their thing, I hope. Okay, what do
you want to have 5 minutes of questions?
Okay. Oh yeah, that's right. Do we have time?
Any comments, questions? That huge camera on your side.
That huge camera is the largest camera ever made. It weighed about 1,600 pounds. It took 15 people to operate it. The negative was a glass plate negative that was 10 feet by 8 feet. And it only ever took one photograph. It was made because there was a man who had a brand new train engine, and he wanted a photograph of it to be shown at the Paris Exposition. And he didn't want a photo that was put together. When the photographer said, I will have to put together several plates, he said, no. So he hired George Flashlight Lawrence, an incredible photographic inventor, to make this thing. They made the photograph. A boy had to put the emulsion on with a broom. This all had to be done, put on there, take the photograph, and do it up basically at the same time. When the photo was shipped to Paris, nobody believed that it was real. They said it was a fake. So they had to send the French consul to the United States to come to Chicago, where this thing had been made, to prove that in fact it was.
Only one photo?
Yes.
Because it was a picture.
Yes, but what would you need photos that big for in the first place?
Well, you think it would be in a fair.
Well, it was in this Paris Exposition.
If I may, I want to show you something that feeds into her vein that I brought in connection with the teenage immigrant welfare mothers who dropped. In 1995, the Isthmus brought a big story with this title page about Benita Freeman, a African-American woman with 5 children on welfare, who was expecting her 6th child and who was quite indignant that she couldn't now under W-2 get the funds to take a pre-med course at MATC and go to the university. It was a rather controversial story, but I wanted to show you what the photographer did. This was the front page picture, sort of a nice thing, the mother surrounded by children. The inside picture got a little more intense. They put a black frame around it, and now if you look closely, it's very much the old image, time-honored image, of the Madonna surrounded by little angels. And the last picture The last picture was a very sweet portrait surrounded by black, which is usually, you know, indicating something dying and so on and so forth. There was a lot of, I personally thought she was a very bad example to choose for sympathy. But the photographer used his skills as a layout person to make this point. And I'm sure that there were, if anybody remembers, widely divergent opinions on this among this very congregation. But it's kind of an interesting thing on what you were saying on photography. Yeah.
I saw an image that interestingly ties together what both of you have talked about today. And I hope that if it is still up, it has some kind of commentary next to it. But it was at the Circus World Museum in Baraboo. And it had one of these, similar to your picture of the zoo people. It had a black person, and it was an actual flyer for a circus, and the heading under, or the title underneath said, "What is it?" question mark. And it was not a very flattering image of a black person. Well, but it was a historical image of a circus flyer. And I thought, how many thousands and thousands of people have seen that, and seen that image in modern times without any explanation and still having the same impact that it had historically. I think I did talk to someone who worked in the Historical Society at that time about it, and I haven't been up, and I don't know if you know about it.
Well, the thing that you have to know, and that's why you have to be careful of the 1990s moral kind of attitudes, is that, for example, people who worked in circuses, the people who were the freaks actually had their photos made and then they would sell them. Mm-hmm. They would sell them to get extra money. And there were certain conventions that had to do with circus life. In this case, they're trying to bring somebody in, you know, when they sell the bearded lady or all those kinds of things, you know, they're doing that kind of thing. And so that's the problematic thing. If we look at something, and that's what happens all the time.
Here's where I think that the curator was at fault for not
saying
explaining
that to
what
me.
Is this,
yes.
Or saying
yes.
It to the black child that goes
absolutely.
There and sees that. And this is where I call the curator.
Yes.
That's very interesting, Delina, because a similar thing happens with the people in the ethnic shows. I talked to the person in charge of the archives there, and there were two messages. Some of the leading figures in these displays, who were the fathers and sort of the group leaders, came back to Frankfurt and told that when they went back to their African small villages, they were regarded as the widely traveled, newly experienced leaders. So they had an important aura. But on the other hand, the little people among them, there was a great degree of mortality. Many of them died because of the different and the fairly poor conditions under which they lived. And so there was even a class division between the people in these ethnic displays.
There's a technical point about color film and race. As you know, different people who make color film have to choose different photosensitive dyes, and so you get different color film will give you different images, different balances of colors. And my understanding is that the most widely used color films are biased from objective reality, because the best films make white people look sort of beefy. And so they choose the mixture of dyes that make white people look whiter, but the effect is to make black people look blacker.
Oh.
Well, that also has to do with people not understanding how the technical qualities of photography. Nowadays, to me, it's quite horrifying, but students who are taught photography are not taught how to understand what they're doing. And one of the things about photography is if you understand and you're photographing someone who's black, you make the settings different. And, you know, you make the settings different so that you get a nice quality of image. But that's something that comes with the understanding of what a camera does and what film does.
It does make O.J. Simpson look black.
Okay,
I
thought
it was the last.
Yeah.
It makes you,
you've had your hand up for a while.
I had a really strong emotional reaction to the sort of pejorative images of black people, the German ones. I come from a family that's, I'm Jewish on my father's side, and my whole family was wiped out in Europe. So I'm having a very strong emotional reaction because my background is partly one of those people that some Germans and other people consider to be non-human. So I'm like just getting choked up, and I'm having a strong emotional reaction to that, maybe as if I were a black person sitting here. Mm-hmm. Because I'm taking it, you know, extremely personally. Mm-hmm. Because that attitude transferred to another group of people is really personal.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you that those images were used. Those images were used to dehumanize Jews. And the point of doing this is to make you understand that the images that you're looking at now.
Well, I'm just having like this incredible strong emotion.
This is what people do in images. This is what is done. And what she showed is how the image changed, and this beautiful image of St. Maurice, and how it changed over time, and people accepted that.
It's part of the same thinking that you're talking about is what allowed, you know, Hitler to kill gypsies and gay people and Jews and whoever else was on the list.
But you can see from your reaction how important it is to never show anything without historical commentary to understand. Right. And I had brought some imagery from Nazi public art, which I didn't get to sometime. Maybe I'll do a program on that sometime. It's very, very important that when, as she said, look at the thing, at the historic background, the political background, and from when we do that, we can really learn to look at similar things today. And of course, images of blacks that you saw here, the same were, could be found in the, or I found in American images of the turn of the century, same thing.
The thing is for you to understand, and that's why I tell you about the technical things, the photographers, images are not real. They are what the photographer wants to tell you. That's all a photograph is.
But the thought process and attitude that created
right, that's what you have to know.
It's the same thought process
yes.
that killed
yes.
his family.
That's yeah. right. And right. that's why you should know that. And even subtle images like she showed in the isthmus here, you should be aware of. The sad thing is that we get no visual training. Mm-hmm. This is that's a classic Madonna. That's a classic thing that evokes in people in a Christian background a particular feeling. And if you don't have training in how visual things are put together and what they mean, then you are manipulated by those. The person knows what they're doing. The photographers, when they go out in this book, Rich and Poor, when you go through this book, you go, oh, rich people are just destitute. Rich people, oh, they're just, you know, their lives are depressing. Forget it. It's a wide-angle lens and people sitting on the edge of a bed. It's because this man wants to tell you that rich people lead sad, empty lives. And that's the purpose for doing this, to say the more you understand about how these things manipulate you, the more you understand what the photographer or the artist is trying to make you think.
Barbara, I think we had that. She indicated we need to stop.
Well,
I think that's a wonderful
commentary on just how images affect us, affect our lives. Very, very insightful comment. Thank you. That was very And I'm wondering if there's any visitors or guests who would like to introduce themselves or be introduced.
I would like to introduce a new roommate of mine, Mr. Larry Jan Ko. She likes to be known as Jan. So she got me talking about prairie, and so she wanted to come.
Welcome. Are there any prairie announcements?
Nobody signed up for coffee cleanup today, and there's nobody signed up for greeting coffee beyond today. Oh, sorry. I just signed up for the 20th.
Do we have any volunteers for doing
coffee? You don't know what it doesn't mean.
Do we have any volunteers who are willing to do coffee cleanup today? Oh, okay. Let's have a couple of you here. Okay. That's great. Thank you. Benji.
This is quite an announcement, but I need to do a very, very expensive carpentry job on the back porch of my house. And I'd like someone to recommend a good carpenter to me. Get on the carpenter.
For people who are interested in Spanish culture and Spanish language, we have a Spanish speakers potluck here tomorrow night at 7. Anyone is welcome to come. If you can, bring a dish to pass. We make a real effort to speak Spanish for an hour and a half or so, and any level is welcome. If you need a ride, call Kate Tucker or me. I'm Rosemary Dorn.
Right. Your social action committee is asking for homeless shelter volunteers. There are a little bit of your time. It was a real long way for providing comfort for some men destitute. And we're looking for sign-up. Shifts are the fourth Monday and Tuesday of the month, so that starts, again, next Monday and Tuesday, short of 2 to 3 hour shifts. Please give me a call or check with me before you go to that. Also, we got a book sale coming, the big fundraiser for the Social Action Committee. So if you get another request, hang on to those good books, CDs, LPs, give us a call. We can pick them up, get them out of your life, and put them into the system again.
Other announcements. Okay, then let's sing our last hymn, which is number 22 in the book. Thank you.